Hello and welcome to Comedy in a Nutshell. I'm your host, Mark Decano, and every episode of this podcast, I talk to someone in comedy about what comedy actually means to them. The succinct will come up with a single word answer. Others need a paragraph, and for some, there simply aren't words enough. And those people are on a different podcast. You can find out more about my journey in comedy fandom on my website, thecomedynerd.com. I love talking to the people in comedy about comedy. If you like to hear what they have to say as much as I do, then please like, subscribe, rate, review, and share the podcast. Thank you. My guest this episode is an actor, writer, and comedian with multiple Edinburgh shows under his belt, as well as two seasons of sitcom Buffering, which he co-wrote and co-stars with Ian Sterling. It's stand-up comedian Steve Bougeier. Why don't we wind the clock all the way back? How did comedy become part of your life? How did it manifest itself?
I think watching sitcoms was my first interaction with comedy. Well, I did like probably kids shows, really, like kids sitcoms. Like Saved by the Bell was like one of my favourite shows in the world. Mm-hmm. And that is like a sitcom, really. If you watch it, it's a very traditional sitcom.
Yeah.
And I used to just love it. And then I think as I got a bit older, things like Gavin and Stacey came along, and The Office a bit before that. And I just thought it was brilliant that people would create things purely for create laughter, you know, or at least evoke emotions. I just thought it was a superpower. Then when I sort of discovered stand-up, I just thought that was the most brilliant thing in the world, that someone could just engage that many people and make them laugh. Like, their only intention was to make them laugh. I just thought it was what an amazing job.
Yeah. Were there people then that inspired you to make a start in it yourself?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I remember getting bought Peter Kay's DVD, Top of the Tower.
Yeah.
When I was like maybe 11 or 12 and thinking, you know, just like mesmerized by it. But I don't think then I ever thought I'd be a stand-up. It wasn't like I dream of it, because I don't think you realistically ever think you can. Like, I came from, you know, a background where I didn't really know anyone who was creative. Like, I didn't know anyone, none of my family are creative. No one, I never interacted with anyone who made a living out of being creative. So it was never really a realistic job. I guess I just thought it was cool. And then when I got to university, I met other people who had similar, like, geeky love of comedy. And then we kind of dared each other to do stand-up. And then from there, I kind of got into the circuit in Manchester, where I went to university.
Yeah.
And then it became, you know, obviously then you meet people who do make a living out of it.
Yeah.
And it became more attainable at that point. So I never, like... I know a lot of comedians sort of say, oh, I dreamed of being it from a young age. And I didn't really, because it never seemed possible. Like, not even, I shouldn't even thought of it. It wouldn't even be, you know, like, you wouldn't even think, it's not like, oh, that would never happen to me. It was just like, you wouldn't even think of doing it.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I was a bit older when you'd come into touch, you know, and come into contact with the people who do the job that you think looks cool.
Yeah.
Do you actually think it's possible?
Yeah. It's interesting. It's the most common story is that the comedians I talk to is that they fell into it by accident, or they were tricked into it, or they were forced into it. And then you've just said there is that you were dared into it. So what was your entry into comedy in that respect?
Well, I actually did my first gig at I was working on a summer camp in America, like looking after children during the summer. Yeah. And there was a staff talent contest, and I entered it doing stand-up. And I don't really remember why I did that. Like, I think I just felt it's funny. I think there was something about being in a new group of people. I could, like, reinvent myself, you know, like I wasn't the geeky one at school or, you know, at uni. So I could be the funny one. And I just had a rush of confidence and did it.
Yeah.
And wrote some jokes with my friend Tom, well, who's my new friend at the time. I only met him a few days before. And and just like felt alive when I did the gig. It felt brilliant. And then when I came back to Manchester, where I was at university, I just sort of started in the odd open mic. It took me a while to get into it, but over the next few years, I just started doing gigs. And then I think I just felt like I belonged. Like it was the first time in my life that maybe I felt us with people and doing something that made me feel safe. And like I had a purpose in life.
Yeah. Was that a point at which you started to consider yourself or call yourself a comedian, or did that come later, or has it ever come?
I don't really remember when I actually started calling myself that. I think I was very conscious not to call myself that quite for a while because it's a bit embarrassing. but I mean, it's just lame in it to call yourself a comedian when you're not really. But I probably wouldn't have said it until when I won the BBC New Comedy Award, maybe in 2013. Mm-hmm. That's when I started being like, okay, I guess I'm a comedian.
Right.
I think when I got an agent, I was like, all right, I'm a comedian. But that's not to say you're not a comedian without an agent, because it was just like I felt like a fraud, basically.
So that first gigs then that you did, because of what you'd seen of stand-up, did that translate to what you experienced doing it for the first time?
I don't know. I think in that first gig, I don't know if I was actually trying to be anyone. I don't know if I was trying to copy anyone. I think I wrote jokes about the summer camp.
Right.
So it wasn't like I was doing routines like Lee Evans or, you know, whoever was Peter Kay or whatever, who I was watching at the time. I think I literally just wrote some jokes about, so I was just trying to make my new friends laugh.
Right.
So I don't know if there was a distinct style or anything. It was just memorizing these jokes and saying them. I think the thing that I used to do a lot of debating in school, I used to like do debate club. I was reasonably good at public speaking. Like I was reasonably comfortable with public speaking. So I think that was closer to how I did stand up. Like I delivered it like I would a debating society, which sounds a bit weird, but I wasn't trying to be a stand-up. When I was on stage, I didn't feel like I was copying anyone. I was just doing how I was, you know, I was comfortable with public speaking. So I was just doing my public speaking about saying funny things rather than points about corporal punishment or whatever the debating society was debating that week.
So as an experienced public speaker then, I guess that the nerves didn't play a huge part, or did they? Was it a different experience?
Yeah, I was nervous.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure I was nervous because it's like, oh, is this going to be funny? Is this going to be embarrassing? Because there's something like particularly exposing about going in front of a group of people and saying you're funny, you know, thinking you're funny. But I guess I wasn't nervous about being on stage, no.
Yeah. So what about then, you said you won the BBC New Comedy Award in 2013, and then since then you've been at the Edinburgh Fringe many times with shows. How has your Fringe experience and how has that experience changed over time since then?
I think I'd never heard of the Edinburgh Fringe. Like I didn't know what it was when I was in my early 20s. So then when I sort of discovered it in 2010, I went for the first time, but not as a performer. I just went to watch it. I had only done like one or two gigs at that point, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is the most magical place on earth. And it was also extremely daunting and intimidating. And then I think I went back in 2012 and did a mixed bill show with some friends, and that's when I started to feel like, okay, this is how you do it. But still then, like the idea of doing a solo show, fear felt like completely impossible. Like it felt mad to write an hour of stand-up and perform it. And then in 2013, I did a slightly longer solo show, like 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'd say that was the year that I improved the most. You know, like I think when there's early years, your improvement can be rapid,
right?
Because you obviously start from such a low base. And I did this gig in a tent, a yurt, in the Three Sisters courtyard, which was so loud. It was 7 p.m. every night. I was just fighting with the noise. But it would always be packed because there was only like 30 people in there. So like, you know, you always get that many in. And it was great. And I felt like I improved, like I really, my confidence grew, my ability to turn over new material got better. Like I try out new stuff all the time and I just got better at taking that risk.
Yeah.
And because you can, like it didn't matter. There was no consequences.
Yeah.
It didn't always go well, but no one knew. and I think that was, yeah. And then I was also doing the lunchtime special, which was like a package show with the lineup. Actually, now I look back on it, it's absolutely insane. Like the lineup that year was me, Fern Brady, Pierre Novelli, Brennan Reese, Laura Lex and Kwame Asante. And like all of those people have gone on to do really quite impressive things. And Kate Lucas as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really good lineup. And we didn't do every show every, I can't remember, I did like 10 shows this month.
Right.
And we were in the Tron, which is actually where I'm doing my show this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was brilliant. And I think that was when I started to feel like I belonged at the Fringe. I started to get it. I felt like I was part of a generation of comedians. I had friends and all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And 14, I was signed to a management company and did their package show in the courtyard, Pleasant's Courtyard.
Yeah.
Then I started to think about doing a solo show at that point. I was like, okay, I've seen friends do it now. I can see how it works.
Mm.
And then writing my first show in 2015 was really difficult. It was really, and I set about doing a completely new show. I didn't just like do all my best material.
Mm-hmm.
I put some of my material into it, but like I largely wrote a brand new show because it was a story show about picking a prisoner up and taking to his daughter's wedding. And
yeah,
it was this like particular story. And I was really proud that I did that. Like I really, and I felt making that decision to do quite a brave, like, new show, whereas a lot of my peers were just putting all their best material together.
Right.
It massively helped me as a writer because it taught me that I can write a show.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it was easy, but it meant I wasn't scared of writing a show, whereas I think a lot of people, and this is completely normal, go up to the Fringe, their first Fringe, and just do all their material they've written for the last, whatever, 4 years. And then the idea of doing a second show seems absolutely crazy because they're like, oh, God, I spent 5 years writing that.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, although there was definitely some old material in it, it didn't feel as daunting because I was like, well, I created that show in a year, so I can do it again. So I think that helped me just like churn out shows every year and be quite confident with that. And definitely in that first, I mean, I did 3, 4, 5 shows back to back before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. Like, it was brilliant. I mean, don't get me wrong, there was times where I hated it, but I largely loved being creative and coming up with new stuff and different stories and different types of show. And I felt like I was quite, I was improving. Yeah, every year.
Right.
So yeah, I think it's mad to look back in like 2012 and think at the time writing a show seemed impossible and unachievable.
Yeah.
And then I got to a stage in sort of 2017, 2018 where I was like, right, let's do another one. And I was busier and busier. And you just sort of learn to write. And I think that's the best thing about stand-up, like that feeling of improvement, you know, that feeling of clear, tangible improvement, which I know a lot of people in their jobs maybe don't get that.
Yeah.
You know, their improvement maybe is a bit more gradual.
Mm.
Whereas, because you have to every year, you can really see the progress.
Yeah. Was there anything that surprised you about doing comedy, either doing it at the Fringe or being part of this new group of peers or the industry side of it? Is there any surprises?
I think I was amazed at how hard it was, to be honest.
Right.
Like how hard people had to work to get to the level that you see on TV and stuff.
Mm.
And it's still very difficult to explain that to people unless they see it. Like how, and that's not to be like, oh, we work so hard. I just mean, you just see how talented some people are.
Mm.
And sometimes they still can't get there. And it's like really difficult. So that surprised me, I think. But it also excited me and made it feel like an adventure.
Yeah.
And I think I've always been slightly surprised by how supportive everyone is. Like, I think it is a very supportive community. And how many, I'm very grateful for, because comedy does attract a wide range of people.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of conversations around whether it cuts off people from more working class backgrounds and that's a valid conversation.
Hmm.
But I've got lots of friends who do comedy from all sorts of backgrounds. Some who went to Eton, and then some who, grew up in very working class Wigan, and I don't know whether I would have had that mixture of friends if I'd got a normal job.
Yeah.
And that's a brilliant thing about comedy, and it could definitely improve, but it is amazing that exists.
What about when you go up in competition with your peers? So, for example, we mentioned already the BBC New Comedy Award, or also if you're competing with your Edinburgh show against hundreds or even thousands of other shows for an audience, how do you feel about the competitive element?
I think when you're doing competitions, new act competition, it's a bit more stark competition because it's very clear that you're one and one.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be difficult. I don't think you ever take it too personally. Because sometimes it just came down to the gig on the night, like I did all the new act competitions. I got to the final of, I think, all of them at some point, not all in the same year, but I did at some point get to like Laughing Horse and Moose, BBC, and got beaten on most occasions. And then I just happened to win the BBC one. I think doing the competitions is some of the hardest bit of comedy because it's a bit of a lottery, to be honest. Down to like who performs well that night and how the audience reacts. It's not really, I wouldn't say it's a great measure of who's the best. Edinburgh's a bit different because although you are in competition, I wouldn't say it's direct. Like I'm not going on directly after Pierre Novelli doing my hour to the same audience. Like that's competition. Whereas in a competition, in the Laughing Horse, I had to follow someone and that's harder.
Hmm.
So I think Edinburgh, you don't feel it as much.
Obviously, you've also written for other comics, like you've written for Russell Howard, Ian Sterling, you've written jokes for 8 out of 10 Cats, Mock the Week. Are you happier as an actor, as a performer, or as a writer? Where's your comfort area?
I don't tend to think about it too much. Like which one I prefer, because I don't think you have to choose.
Right.
I think it's just like comedy is comedy, and you can exercise that skill in many different ways. I love performing. I would never stop doing stand up and performing.
Mm.
That buzz is brilliant, but you do have to earn a living, and doing writing jobs is sometimes a way of paying for that. And that's also really fun. Like working with Russell Howard was such a brilliant educational experience. He's such a hardworking, talented comedian that, you give him a joke and he would just get up in the room and perform it to you to a level that I couldn't have performed that joke that well after about 20 shows, let alone do it immediately in the room. Like he's so instantly good at delivering material, and that's such a skill that can be underrated. It can be underestimated how hard that is to do. Ian's very good at that as well. Like just you give him an idea and he'll just be able to deliver it to a level that is quite high. I love writing for other people, but I wouldn't want to not stop performing. But I see it as all part of the same pie, sort of see it as, it's just like, it's all comedy, it's all writing comedy.
Yeah. Do you envision in your mind's eye when you're writing material, you can see something that Russell Howard or Ian Sterling would perform that you couldn't, or something that you would do that they would deliver very differently?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when you write for other people, people always ask, like, oh, don't you ever want to keep the jokes yourself? I'm like, well, you don't. It's unlikely I'd write the same joke. Mm. And if you have written the same joke, you've probably not written a very good joke. So you never really think about it. I think it's amazing to watch someone else do your material. Like, it's a real, like, I remember writing, I mean, obviously I watched Russell do it on the TV, but there was a time I wrote for Ian and his partner, Laura. They were hosting a big, like, ITV end of year party. It wasn't actually on TV. It was just like a kind of corporate-y thing.
Right.
I wrote the script for it. And I was in the crowd, and I felt such level. I felt so proud watching them say these jokes, and they just did it so well. And I just, and there were all these laughs, and I just felt like it didn't feel like I was delivering the jokes, but it did feel like a level of pride that I think I was surprised by, actually.
Mm.
Yeah, it's good. I quite like it.
Yeah. Talking about if you're writing for other people and obviously their style, your style, the person that you are on stage, is that you, or is it a version of you or an extension of you?
Yeah, I think it's a version of me. It's interesting because I think it's evolved over time. Like, I think when I started out, I was much more of the nerd, of the kind of like shy, awkward nerd from school who couldn't get any girls. That was kind of the shtick. Like, the kid who I always used to word it as, like, it's the kid who got bullied but is now doing stand up. And that, I think, worked up to a point.
Hmm.
But I think as you get a bit older, you can't really have your persona rooted in like your past as much, because it was very much rooted in I was the loser and now I'm just, whereas now I think it's developed a bit. Like, I'm obviously, there's still an element of nerd to it. There's still an element of like neurotic and overthinking, which is definitely true. It's definitely part of me, but I wouldn't say it's, I'd say off stage I'm more confident and less of a worrier than I am on stage. Like, I turn up those bits of my character to the comedy, because it's just not as funny.
In your performance, you are a storyteller, I would say. Do you start with the story, or do you have jokes that you change the narrative to suit? What is your style in that sense?
It's variable show to show.
Yeah.
The past two shows have been much more like stand-up driven.
Mm.
So not the one I did last, the ones that have actually been to the Fringe so far.
Yeah.
They were much more just stand-up. They were just like standing a sort of thread of, not a narrative, but like a theme through it.
Mm.
But actually, my first five shows actually, were all stories, and they started with a story. They all started with like a, you know, the first one was taking a prisoner to his daughter's wedding, and then like it was one about summer camp, and it was like, this is all about me working on a summer camp with autistic children.
Mm.
And I think this year I'm going back to that, like going, here's the story, and then you build the jokes around it, which I find is much easier. Because you're much more constrained, like, you know what the story is. Like, so you can't, if I write a joke about washing machines, I just know that I can't use that because it doesn't fit the story, or at least if it's too long, I can't use it. So, whereas when you write a stand-up show, it's like, oh, anything could go in here.
Yeah.
And it just becomes a bit, actually, that lack of limitations quite difficult.
Right. If you're writing the from a story point of view, do you look back and think what story has happened that I might develop into a show? Or are you, at the time that it happens, thinking I can get 10 minutes from this?
No, I think when it comes to big art, like hour-long story ones, like Edinburgh Show, I think in the last few years, I've not really had one. Like, not enough's happened in my life of story note. Only this year have I gone, oh, okay, here's a story.
Hmm.
And then I plucked it out. Whereas my first five were kind of from the past. So obviously I had all my life to go from. So, you know, there was a whole show about my mum growing up. So that's like her being a single mum. So that was when I was a kid. And the summer camp was like when I was 19, before I did stand up. And the day release one, the prisoner one had happened like the 2 years before. So like I was like mining my past, whereas now, not that I've run out of stories, but I've run out of like big, meaningful life events. But now I've got another one because I guess I've lived a bit. So that's good. That's helpful.
So the show that I saw you working on in this year's Leicester Festival was a new work in progress, and in which you talk about working with Ian Sterling, writing and creating the TV show Buffering.
Yeah.
Without giving away too much of a future show still in its development, what can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I mean, this was like really dream come true stuff. Ian obviously became very successful with the voice of Love Island, and it opened up opportunities to pitch sitcom, and then we developed it together. So I've been writing sitcoms for years on my own or with various other writing partners.
Yeah.
And like that was always something I wanted to do. And I've been on lots of courses, you know, writing courses and all that sort of geeky shit. And then we got opportunity, I guess, and Ian was very kind to let me involved, and we worked with our management company Avalon, who make TV shows, and we developed it, and then we pitched it to various channels, and then we got a few offers and things, and then ITV commissioned it for a series, and then the pandemic happened, and we had to wait for a year, but it was weird, but it didn't feel real for a while, and I think even when I was doing it, I was a bit like, this is insane. Like, this is, I couldn't have ever thought this would happen. And it's not to say I was like skipping along all the time and happy. Like, there was a really stressful moment. And it's like anything, like whatever you achieve, you still have a rubbish day, you know, like you still wake up in a bad mood and you have to go and film a TV show. Like it's, I know it sounds silly, but it's not like you're always happy, but I definitely felt a level of gratitude, particularly in series two, where I let it sink in a bit more. Where series one was just stressful because I was like, oh my God, we've got to get this right. And there was a pandemic and it was just a lot going on.
Yeah.
Whereas series two, I was just so grateful we got a series. I was just like, oh, well, we've done it. We've done two series. That's all I really ever, you can't really ask for more than that. Because then, you know, it's very rare to get, well, it's rare to get a sitcom, let alone two series. So I very much had an attitude of like, well, let's just enjoy it. Let's just like work hard, but let's just make sure we take in every moment. And I think I definitely did in that second series. Like every day I look forward to going in, just being on set and writing. And it was just, everything was so, so much fun. And felt incredibly lucky. And I learned a huge amount. Like I worked with some brilliant people, some great script editors, and I learned how to construct a story. And it was a bit weird because you're kind of learning in a very public way. Like, you know, there's no way of knowing how to write a sitcom until you do it. Like, obviously you can write scripts and pilots, but you don't actually know how it works until someone has to film it and turn it. And then you go into the edit and then you realize, oh shit, this all changes in the edit. Like, you can't really learn that until you do it. And it's quite a public way to learn craft. And every writer's been through it. You know, everyone, if you look at everyone's first sitcoms, you sort of, you can see they've learned and developed through it. I definitely felt that. I felt like by series two, I was just an infinitely better writer and a more practical writer as well. Like, I understood what went into it and how money, a budget affected decisions and things like that, things that you wouldn't even think about when you're first writing a sitcom. You know, like having the number of characters in a scene being more than four, you just know that's going to take up more time because of the filming. And so you'd write more sensibly. And like, it sounds really boring, but like, that is just the nature of writing, unless you've got like a massive Netflix show where the budget's, you know, infinite. But I felt like I learned a lot, and it was just a brilliant experience. And now I feel things I write now, and pitch, I feel way more equipped to do it now. Like, I'm very confident in what I produce now.
Yeah. The difference there being, I imagine the main difference being that when you perform stand-up, the feedback on whether you're writing something that works or doesn't work is immediate.
Yeah.
If you're putting something together, obviously for filming and then release, you're not going to get as much or possibly as effective feedback.
No, exactly. And also, everyone who's giving you feedback is kind of involved in the show.
Yeah.
So they're kind of in the woods as well. So you're all kind of blind to some of the mistakes that you're making. And that's kind of normal. And it's only when it comes out and you have a bit of perspective, you're like, we should have done this, or that was a mistake. Or you know, nice way, you go, oh, that was good, we did that. Or that was lucky. We made that. It works both ways. And I think we definitely tried to learn a lot of lessons in series two. And I think it really improved. And we worked with some really, really good people. We changed our script. We got our script editor. We didn't have a script editor in series one, which was a mistake. But she was brilliant. She called Kate, and she was just like, I learned so much from her. And I felt like we produced something in series two that was really, I was like super, super proud of. I think the actors in it are great, and I think they did a brilliant job. And I was pleased we got the chance to do series two, because I think if we'd just got series one, I'd have always been like, we can do better. You know, and I imagine that's how everyone feels after their first series. And, you know, maybe the exceptions. I don't know, maybe like Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant were fairly happy. I don't know. I was so grateful to do the series two and be like, oh, no, that's my best work. In that time, you know? So that was a good feeling.
You've mentioned the pandemic a couple of times. Mm-hmm. So with a great career, and then suddenly everything grinds to a halt, and obviously it put back sitcom production. How did you go into lockdown? What was your experience of what could have been or what was?
I was relatively lucky. Like, I was about to go on tour with Ian, but the sitcom was commissioned, and it was due to be coming out in summer 2020, we'd actually filmed two episodes, and then we were due to film four more, but then that all got delayed. So then we had two episodes in the can, and then we had an extra year added on to film the next four.
Yeah,
which was kind of good from a writing perspective, but it was also very uncertain. We didn't know whether we were going to ever get to make it, or you know, a lot of budget things changed because of the pandemic and things. So it was very stressful. But I had obviously a lot more time. And I enjoyed a lot, like everyone, I enjoyed it slowing down. And, you know, although I missed gigging, I did appreciate not having to be out every night. And I was very fortunate living at my girlfriend at the time's parents, and they have like a lovely house, and they were very, it was like a nice life. They had a dog. It was great. but I wrote every day is what I did. And I really enjoyed that. And it's a luxury that, you know, it's hard to have, because writing doesn't necessarily pay enough or like immediately. Like, sometimes it's like a long-term project. So you can't like rely on it until you're rich. You have to gig. But obviously the pandemic costs came down and stuff, so it didn't matter so much. And we had buffering. So yeah, I was lucky. I was definitely one of the lucky ones. And I felt like I used the pandemic reasonably productively. I look at some of my friends who like became massive online and stuff, and I'm like, oh, I probably could have done that. But there's no way of knowing, is there?
Yeah. Did you try and engage with the new technology, things like Zoom gigs and drive-in gigs, that sort of thing? How did that fit in?
Yeah, I didn't do any drive-in ones, but I did the Zoom ones.
Yeah.
I didn't mind them, actually. They were quite fun. Definitely worked the same in terms of trying new material and finding out whether things are funny. I didn't do loads. because of the, I guess I wasn't desperate to do gigs because I had the sitcom. But we, yeah, we did like read throughs on Zoom, and I mean, I spent my life on Zoom writing in, you know, in writers' rooms with Ian and Sally O'Leary and various other co-writers. So I was never off Zoom really.
Yeah.
But not always doing gigs.
Yeah. Do you watch stand-up comedy? Do you watch sitcoms, and do you see them in the same light as you once did? Or now that you are an experienced comedian and writer of sitcoms, do you now see them with a comedian's mindset?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you can't help but change how you view it. Like sitcoms in particular, I am now far less critical. I really understand how hard it is and how, you know, what comes out on TV isn't necessarily what you envisaged. You know, I understand all the roadblocks that get in the way of making something. So I'm much more sympathetic to that. And with stand-up, yeah, I can't really watch stand-up without analysing it. Like, I can't really... I enjoy it, but I don't enjoy it like I maybe used to. But I think that's just normal. I sit there and I sort of analyse the structure and I predict what the callbacks are going to be. And I think about, you know, if I hear a particularly good joke, I'm like, oh, that's good. How did they do that? You know, rather than just laugh at it, which is, yeah, I've sort of ruined my, hobby really. But, and it's the same, but I guess like watching something live is the same as well. Like you just go, oh, they've done well there, you know, or they've, someone does a good bit of crowd work, you're just like, oh, okay, yeah, that's clever.
Yeah.
Whereas it's funny in a green room, comedians don't really laugh. They just kind of sit there and go, that's good. Yeah, that's a good bit.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's taken any of the joy out of it because it's now a work thing and not a entertainment?
I mean, yeah, I think on some level it has.
Yeah.
But I don't think you really can complain about that. It's just what happens when you make your hobby your job.
Yeah.
Like any job, isn't it? You can't love everything. But ultimately I'd rather be doing it for a job than doing it as a hobby. So
Yeah.
The answer is yes, but it doesn't really matter. I think, I still get joy from it though. Like, you know, doing a new joke still feels amazing, just as it did then.
Yeah.
And I still feel like if I see a really good new stand up, I still get excited by that and, you know, laugh. But I guess, some of the magic has gone, I'd say.
Yeah. Do you see people now that are able to still inspire you to either do new things or to do different or better things?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that happens all the time. Yeah, like I used to watch Sarah Kendall's shows in Edinburgh, and I just absolutely love Sarah. I think she creates the most brilliant stories, and she's always someone I watched and looked up to in terms of her style of Edinburgh show. And she always inspires me. Like I sometimes listen back to some of her shows, even now, like ones I've heard already, just to remind myself how brilliant they are. loads of stand-ups do that for me. It's more the storytelling ones that get me. Like I love watching jokes and I go, oh yeah, that's a great joke. But the ones that I'd say inspire me are the ones like Mike Birbiglia. I went and watched Mike Birbiglia's show in London recently, and I was just like, oh yeah, that's when I feel most energized, when I'm watching someone do that, like take you on a journey and kind of all that stuff. That's I guess that's just what I love doing. So it's what inspires me most.
Yeah. So what then are the most important lessons that you've learned so far?
In comedy, I'd say like be prolific, like write a lot is key. Don't be precious about what you write. Like, I think it's quite easy at the beginning to be like, oh no, this is my best joke, you know, or this is my only sitcom idea, or you know, and if someone knocks it or rejects it, then you get really hurt by it. But actually, you've got to recognize that you've got loads of ideas. Like, if you came up with one idea, you can come up with another one, and you've just got to be prolific. And sometimes I fall into that trap as well. Like, I regularly go,
oh, no, these are the ideas. Of, well, I don't know if I'll ever have a good idea again.
And then you just have to sit down and do it. Because writing, I think, is a skill that can be learned and practiced. I don't believe in, like, it's some natural thing that someone's just happens to be funny. Like, yeah, there are funny people, but you can learn to be funny and you can learn how to write and you can repeat it. Like, you can, you know, it's a job, isn't it? And you just sit down and repeat it.
Yeah.
It sounds a bit, I make it sound so mechanical and boring. Like, it's brilliant. I just think creativity is like a muscle, in it. And I think if you are engaging that muscle as much as possible, you'll find it easier to create more stuff.
Yeah. So what then have been your worst and best experiences in comedy?
I mean, I've had loads of amazing experiences and I regularly catch myself just going, oh my God, this is brilliant. Like, if I'm performing at some amazing theatre, you know, in front of loads of people, I'm just like, this is mad. Like, I still feel that. That doesn't ever get lost on me, you know? like, I'm about to go on tour with Ian Sterling on, you know, he'll play some amazing theatres.
Yeah.
And that's still really cool when you walk out into a 1,000-seat theatre. Like, that will never get old. And when I do my own tour, later on this year, like May, June, and July, you know, the fact you've got 200 people there to see you, that is just a great feeling. I hope that never goes.
Yeah.
So they're like the happy memories. And like specific memories, like doing Melbourne Comedy Festival for 2 months was just, you know, brilliant. Like the fact anyone would fly you across the world to do comedy and just being in a different country. And that was pretty special. And it's such a good festival and such a good atmosphere. It was like freshest week every week, you know. that's a very happy memory.
Yeah.
And a very, very fortunate that I got to do that. Bad memories, I mean, I guess bad experiences. I mean, just bad gigs. Like, there's some gigs where you just feel like shit and you wonder why you're doing it. And like, you know, and then happen periodically, you just have a bad gig and you're like, oh God, you know. Sometimes when you have to miss out on things, you know, you have to miss my friend's weddings or a night out or just not see people as much as you want because, you know, we work in the evenings. That can be a bit shit. Like, you do have to make sacrifices, but so does everyone in their various jobs.
Yeah.
So I'd say that's the worst bit when you feel like you're missing out on something. Like this summer, I'm doing the Fringe, but I've got to miss like quite a few people's weddings. And I feel really bad about that.
Yeah.
But that's just the choice I've made. So you can't. I mean, it's how it is, isn't it?
You said about playing abroad. Have you found cultural impacts that may have affected how your comedy was received or had to make changes?
Yeah, I did some gigs in Norway recently and they were interesting. Like their English is amazing. But they're very reserved and private in how they laugh.
Right.
So it's a very, like, the laughter is like very, like, ha-ha, and then, like, back down. Whereas Denmark was much more, like, raucous and more like the UK, I'd say. And Sweden was, like, somewhere in between. So we did all three, and it was, like, interesting to see how those cultures did differ. And it wasn't like the Nordics did enjoy the show.
Yeah.
If anything, it was more of them, and they probably were more excited afterwards, but just the way they laugh was very different.
Yeah.
Australia, I'd say, was the same. It basically is the same. I think you notice more differences in the UK, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between regional and city, there's a difference in not how they laugh, but like maybe what they laugh at.
Right.
Slightly, like you have to slightly alter that. And it just comes down to like what their reference points are. And, you know, like if you're talking about something they're not, you know, some London thing or not even a London thing, but it's a kind of thing that really the most of the country don't care about.
Mm.
You know, one of those sort of cosmopolitan things. It's just a bit wanky. Obviously in London, people love that shit. But you know, it's fine. I like doing that. But like you have to be conscious when you go and do a gig in Oldham that they probably don't care and you just need to tell them some funny jokes.
You said, of course, about touring your show this summer. This is your Edinburgh show from 2023, Self Doubt, I think. So what's that show all about? What can we expect?
That show is about indecision. The show is about my inability to make firm decisions and being caught on the fence. And it's me kind of questioning how do people know they're making the right decision in life, like whether it's big life events or like small things, like how to choose a pair of glasses or something. Like I catch myself a lot in indecision, in paralysis, decision paralysis, I call it. And it's a show about that. It's a show about decision paralysis and trying to overcome that inability to make decisions.
Yeah.
And it's fun. It's really funny and silly and of course jokes. And I really enjoyed it with the friends this year. It was fun. And then doing a 26 date tour, I think.
Mm-hmm.
All over the country. Yeah, so please come if you're listening. It's good.
And how can we find out about those tour dates and how we can find out about you?
Yeah, if you just go to my website, stevebugeja.com, Bugeja, Bugeja. and all the dates are on there. And my Instagram and stuff is Steve Bugeja Comedy. And all the links and things are on there. And there's loads of videos and stuff.
Yeah. So my final question is always the same. It's how would you, Steve, sum up comedy in a nutshell?
Comedy is, at its best, it can be a real honor to make people laugh. I sometimes catch myself and go, I did some gigs on the weekend in Liverpool,
mm-hmm.
and you got 400 people there watching you, and you're just doing jokes for 20 minutes, and people come up to you afterwards, and they're just really happy that they laughed for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the jokes didn't really matter. There was nothing, I didn't say anything of any importance. I didn't change any life. I just made people laugh. And so did the other comedians. And sometimes I think that's just great. I think it's brilliant that we can just, our job is to literally bring happiness to people for even a small period of time. I know the Edinburgh Fringe has a slightly bigger purpose. Maybe you might try and be a bit more ambitious, but I really love that. In the clubs or just general comedy nights, our only aim is to walk on stage and make these people happier than they were when they walked in. And that's what a brilliant, what an amazing thing to get to do for your job.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't always do it sometimes, but I like to think even if they hate me, they get some enjoyment out of them not laughing as well. Ideally, they would laugh.
Steve, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, no. Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate it.